These Aboriginal stockmen are on strike. They walked off the job over a month ago. Their wives, children and relatives went with them. This is the Wave Hill mob. Wave Hill is the territory's biggest cattle station, 5,186 square miles. In fact, the biggest in the world.
I think that Australians all over Australia have got to decide whether they think it's right that Macquarie Street, for example, should be owned by the Aboriginals. It goes right
back. But the Aborigines aren't claiming Macquarie Street, are they?
No, but because there aren't any Aboriginals here. Are there?
He said, "Hey, you steal another man's country." And I said, "Well, what was before the bestie born and I born? I said, that was a black fella country."
You mob can sing along to this, eh? Then you'd all become Aboriginal idol, won't you?
Gather round, people, I'll tell you a story, an 8-year-long story of power and pride. The British Lord Vestey, Vincent Lingyari, were opposite men on opposite sides.
Vestey was fat, full of money and muzzle. Beef was his business, broad was his door. Vincent was lean, spoke very little. He had no bank balance, our dirt was his floor.
From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow.
Gathered the wealth of the land, and daily the pressures got tighter and tighter. Gurindji decided they must make a stand. They packed up their swags, started up a walking, and by Wadi Creek they sat themselves down. They said it don't sound like much, but so
Lingyari, he boarded an airplane, landed in Sydney, great big city of lights, and daily he went round, softly speaking his story to all kinds of men from all walks of life.
Vincent sat down with them big politicians. This affair, they told him, it's a matter of state. Let us sort it out while your people are hungry. Vincent said, "No thanks, we know how to wait."
Big things grow.
to you these deeds as proof in Australian law that these lands belong to the Wurundjeri people.
Of something much more. How power and privilege could not move the people. And now where they stand, and they stand no more.
Good night. Go safe. Hooray.
He's a jolly good fellow, for he's a jolly good fellow, for he's a jolly good fellow. And so say all of us, and so say all of us, for he's a jolly good fellow, for he's a jolly good fellow, for he's a jolly good fellow.
And can't blow out bloody
candles. And so say all of us. Hip hip hooray, hip hip hooray, hip hip hooray.
And it's Peter and Brian with you to share a band program, and it's the 600th on the agenda, did you say, Pete?
I said it was 600, and congratulations, Brian. you've been a big part of all that for every program of BAM. Some people have called you a bee for other reasons, but there we go, 600 programs. How'd you do it?
Yeah, well, it started after I finished at school. I've been a school teacher all my life. And at the turn of the century, I gave teaching away, and there were people in the parish who were wanting to set up a radio program for the parish. And that was, who was the first kid off the block there? Who was the founding father?
Oh, that was...
And his wife called Mary. Anyway, he talked me into starting off a program, and I had no idea what a radio program looked like, let alone do anything with it. We had tape recorders and lots of tapes of every program we ever did. So if you want to check the archives, you'd have to check City Dumps from the last 20 years.
Well, that's an interesting thing too, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking about 600 now, but really it was 600 on this computer, on these computers, rather than 600...
total, right.
In total, yes.
Oh, well, so I can make up any figure I like on that one. But it was after school. After teaching all my life, I wanted to still have a captive audience, and this radio program seemed a beautiful way to get a captive audience, and you couldn't even see them, let alone discipline and correct them. So it was a great diversion from teaching.
So I see you're missing out on disciplining the listeners, are you? Is that what you're trying to say there?
No, it's the interaction is different and more civil and much more courteous.
Although you did get a few letters in your time, didn't you?
Yeah, any time I veered off the given line with... I remember throwing in a comment about abortion out of in some strange context, and the lines I thought were dead as a dodo all lit up. So some things touch a nerve, and you know you've really struck a chord, maybe discord, but it's kind of something that lets you know when you are online and people are listening.
Yes, yes, and what people are genuinely interested in or genuinely stirred up by, yes.
Yeah, more the latter, I think. Now seems to get them on the phone and interacting.
Back on the stats now. So you're going to say you've done 60,000 shows, are you? Is that what you... Because we've got 600 on the count on the computers, but, of course, as Brian indicated, he'd taped a number of them and we don't know how many of them were taped. And then later on we went to CD before we actually worked out the computer side of things.
Yeah, put a year on the computer side of things when we went computerised, Peter. Mm-hmm. Roughly when?
Oh, that would have been... that was before I was involved, so...
It's in the early 2000s, is it?
2010, I'd say, at the earliest.
Okay, right. And that would be Peter Tunney and some of these guys.
Yeah, Pat Tunney and Margaret. And then there was David, was the original bloke, the youth worker in the parish, David Waite.
Right.
So he conned you into it. He asked you if you'd like to be involved. And so probably 10 years of programs you did before you started the count on the computer.
I reckon it'd be close to that,
yeah,
because I was involved with a whole range of the blokes who were doing the adult education in the parish, and they wanted the bits of the program of the radio to be in supporting them.
Yeah. So that's how you could afford to move into a bigger house, is it?
The pay wasn't actually terribly impressive.
Oh, hasn't it? I give you 1,000% bonuses every year. I mean, what's going on? Is it? And what, have the bonuses kept with inflation at all? Or? No. It's all been 600 voluntary programs, ladies and gentlemen, and then all the years beforehand completely voluntary. And so it's a service and a gift to the community.
Yes, and it was a gift to myself because of the extraordinarily creative contacts that came. And the current connection here is excellent. So Yeah, it's been good for a retirement program.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Well, that could be the next program you go into, a retirement program. If BAM ever goes, we can do it that way. Now, well, congratulations, a marvellous effort and marvellous support by Margaret, your finance director and wife, and many more to come. And you'll be celebrating. This is our last program for this year, ladies and gentlemen, and possibly in the meantime, before his next program, he'll be celebrating a big milestone in his life.
Yeah, that's... Jesus and myself were Capricorns, so we're... But I was the second week in January, where he was the fourth week in December.
And there they, you go.
Yeah.
He's become more modest over the years, ladies and gentlemen, that way. So, and do you want to disclose the birthday number?
Oh, yeah, it's a big 90, and it's kind of been a long time coming, but I'm delighted to be able to enjoy the 90 years, and Margaret's got a gathering organised for January 14 at a complex where we're living at the moment, so that should be a lovely gathering of the clan.
Be a brilliant time for you and for all the family.
Yes.
Anyway, that's enough celebration. Back to work.
Right. And some of our awesome Aussies today, I had the two women for the program, if they'll ever fit, see what comes.
Very appropriate to have two women on 600th.
Elizabeth Kenny is one and Elizabeth Murdoch is the other. They're two famous and extraordinary Australian women with different backgrounds, and I guess that's something we share with the rest of Australia. Interesting backgrounds.
Probably you couldn't get two more diverse backgrounds than Elizabeth Murdoch and Elizabeth Kelly, and even during their lives, just completely different backgrounds. I mean, Elizabeth Murdoch had wealth all around her, and she wouldn't have been wanting of anything material, and I'm making no positive or negative comment in relation to that. That's just a factual thing for her, whereas Elizabeth Kenny was more self-made and self-reliant, but both brilliant in their own way and what they did with the gifts that they've been given.
Yeah, both extraordinary. For instance, one of Elizabeth Murdoch's secrets, she said, people asked, how do you live to a ripe old age? And she said, you just keep busy, morning, noon and night. And she celebrated her 99th birthday in February 2008, and each day of her life started with a 7 a.m. swim in a country home on Victoria's Mornington Peninsula.
So that would have been a very cold swim sometimes.
A cold start some days. Yeah. Then she makes a cup of tea for a gardener. That's part of this kind of extraordinary average woman. And she had 10 official appointments each week, if you work it out, sometimes as many as three a day. But Dame Elizabeth certainly keeps busy. But she might have added that another element of longevity, at least in her case, because she's one of the greatest Australian philanthropists of modern times. So this woman, born in Melbourne in 1909, her dad was a merchant and her mum came from a farming family in Victoria's Western District, as a lot of beautiful people would share that background. And at the age of 19, she married this certain newspaper owner bloke called Keith Murdoch. He was 22 years older than she and had made himself a name for himself as a reporter at Gallipoli in the First World War. They had a son and three daughters, and Dame Elizabeth's son Rupert is now a bloke you'll know, a global media giant and one of the richest and most powerful men in the world. Dame Elizabeth devoted her life to to the service of others. And she kind of proved it easily. Before marriage, she was a kindergarten teacher, a volunteer for the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. And later she became life patron of the Royal Women's Hospital in Melbourne, a founding member of the Deafness Foundation of Victoria. She's a patron of the Australian Ballet. She has contributed to the arts, medical research, social welfare, protection of Australia flora and fauna. As the Age put it, few can rival Dame Elizabeth's enormous contribution. And so, as she entered her 100th year, Dame Elizabeth had one more birthday observation. Looking out for other people is the most important thing in life and the most rewarding. Well, that's her wisdom and story for today.
A favourite part of that story for me is the fact that she makes a cup of tea for a gardener every morning.
Delightful touch, isn't it?
I can't imagine that happening in many wealthy, wealthy families or uber wealthy families.
Even though she's got a gardener, but yeah. she knew him and cared for him in that lovely way.
Yeah, and it basically does support the words she says at the end of looking out for others.
Yeah,
and that being the most important thing.
Yeah, that includes the cup of tea for the gardener.
I would love to hear discussions between herself and Rupert. because you'd imagine there's disagreements, but there'd be obviously a respect between them.
Oh, huge, huge respect, and a kind of consensus, but not much of the latter.
Yeah, but just to hear their different viewpoints, unfiltered by anything else.
Yeah.
Because they came, well, obviously they're the same family, but their views are so divergent. What created that divergence, and how do they understand each other through that divergence?
Yeah. So, well, he saw his mum enter her 100th year.
Yes.
And he'd know that philosophy, looking out for other people, is the most important thing in life. And he'd know it wasn't just him. He knew the gardener was there as well somewhere and a million other Australians who had grown to honour and love his mum.
Yes. And, I mean, you know, we all live our lives and we all decide to pursue what we do pursue. And we have no idea of Rupert Murdoch's private life. We have no idea of what kind of a person he is. All we hear and see is through his opposition media barons. And so we are in no position to judge any of the famous people we hear about, because we have no idea what they're like. But it would be interesting just to have them both in a room just to discover them and
let them talk about life.
Yeah, their motivations, yes. You know. Because you couldn't imagine, in their public profiles, you couldn't imagine two more contrasting people. But that's obviously not accurate on either side.
No, obviously not. And, well, one day we might get him along for the program. We'll see how we go.
I haven't asked him yet. I'll send him an email and see if he'd like to do a bit of a chat show.
Yeah, chat show. Bring your mum.
And he'd like to join our kind of chat show, because the next topic we're going to talk about is toilets and everything you were afraid to ask. Is it? Look, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you're having a lovely meal at the moment. This is from Grossology Begins at Home, brought to you specially by the gross persons. You race down the hallway. I hope no one beats me into the very special room. You reach the vacated bathroom just in time. It's American. You have to go so bad you can barely stand it. The tinkle of relief. After you pee or dookie in the bowl, you probably just flush it away. Don't even think about it, unless you leave a really stinking one. Then you might remember it for a couple of minutes. Well, there's a whole lot more to the toilet than flush, flush. It's usually an activity, this is me, it's usually an activity flushed with success, but first, the act of flushing causes the water in the bowl to swirl around. The mixing water sends a light mist into the bathroom. That mist has tiny droplets of pee in it, maybe even a couple of poo-poo molecules. If your toothbrush sits out in the open, the mist settles upon it. Good luck cleaning your teeth. That's why the big argument about putting the toilet seat down is so relevant. And the pee and poop isn't all. Some of the droplets might contain tiny bacteria or viruses. Scientists estimate that more than 60,000 contaminated droplets could be released after one flush. The disease-causing drops float around in the air for several hours, then to fall to land on the wall, the faucet, the toilet paper, and pretty much everywhere else.
Only 60,000 drops.
Yes, no problems. Just breathe deeply, you get rid of a few. And the critters will live for several days in their little bubble. If you touch a microbe-filled bubble, you might get sick.
It makes it interesting as the architectural design that the toilets and the bathrooms are somehow guaranteed to link up in most households.
Well, that's right. The ensuite's a classic, isn't it? You're going to have a small room with toilet and bathroom together, and you're going to have this happening every day unless people put the lid down.
Yeah, you presume it happens each day.
Yeah, but even if they put the lid down, the droplets will be floating in that contained area for a couple of hours, so when you lift the lid up next time, some of them will come out.
Watch them. Yeah.
So should I stop flushing? No. Simply wash your hands after you flush, just like your mummy told you to. Besides the toilet paper and toilet water that goes up, water also goes down. The stuff that disappears takes all the crap with it. The next time you flush, check out the downward water. Does it go clockwise or anti-clockwise, counterclockwise? If you live above the equator, the water will always go in a counterclockwise direction. If you live below, it swirls in the opposite direction. If you live on the equator, it just gets confused.
That's weird, isn't it? I wonder how the hemispheres govern the flow of water like that.
Yes, I once actually knew the answer to that, but so it must be available on the internet, ladies and gentlemen.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
After the swirling water is carried away, it combines with other wastewater, such as the water from dirty dishes, the laundry and the shower. Hey, it's a great big wastewater party. If you live in a town or city, your wastewater combines with the crud water from all over the area. It's an even bigger wastewater party, something that you probably wouldn't want to think about. This dirty water...
But it's
water,
so efficient, that's what gets me.
Yeah, the dirty water flows through pipes until it reaches a wastewater treatment plant, also known as a poo-poo factory by a few select people.
Not very select.
No, no. First, the yucky water goes into a huge settling tank at the plant. In the tank, the big stuff like poo, toilet paper, ground-up food and dirt goes to the bottom. The crud on the bottom is called sludge. It's scraped from the tank and sent to digester tanks. Bacteria await the sludge. They love the stuff and they eagerly eat it up. Ah, sludge, my favourite bird part. That's an actual quote from a bacteria, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, yeah. There you go.
Didn't know they spoke English, did you?
I didn't know it was so scientific. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Oh, no. That's not the scientist bacteria. That's just a normal bacteria. The scientist ones go into all the chemical equations that occurred. The bacteria burp and fart so much that most of the sludge is changed into carbon dioxide and methane gas. The carbon dioxide is released into the air. In the fart case, methane is used to power the treatment plant. The sludge is now called mixed liqueur. Would you like a mixed liqueur, Brian?
Yeah, the bloke who designed all this, or the people who designed all this, they should have had medals struck off for them or something. It's been an extraordinarily effective, creative bit of invention, hasn't it?
Well, and if you think about it, it started really from about 1850 onwards.
Yeah, and every town and village and centre and around the planet has got something like that happening.
Yeah, Now, the liquid from the mixed liqueur is removed for further treatment and then released into local rivers and lakes or used to water golf courses and highway landscaping. It's about 95% clean.
I was going to say, I wonder how they assume it's 95% clean.
Well, I suppose with all the treatment they've done...
Yeah, the treatments.
They've got some standards before they can use it.
But they started from a good heap of mess.
Oh, they did. They did, you know. But it's really absolutely amazing how they do it, isn't it?
Yeah, you know? I think to see that system work throughout the planet, you'd have to say, and work so efficiently, I reckon it's one of our modern miracles.
Mm, yeah. I mean, you know... It's not the end of all things. It's the beginning of a lot of things.
The beginning of a lot, yep.
Anyway, that's our toilet story for today. I'm sure you'll appreciate the wonder and the research that goes into this program. And yes, yes, I know. I won't last 600 episodes. Brian might last another 600 episodes, but not me. And you've got some Whitley's, Wrinkley's, wit and wisdom.
Oh, just right. Albert Einstein had this comment on just the living we've got to do. Don't grow old no matter how long you live. Never cease to stand like curious children before the great mystery into which we were all born.
Very wise.
I am more alive than most people. I'm electric eel in a pond of goldfish was Edith Sitwell's comment on it. And Mel Brooks's irreverent comment, look, I don't want to wax philosophic, but I will say that if you're alive, you've got to flap your arms and legs. You've got to jump around a lot, for life is the very opposite of death, and therefore you must at the very least think noisy and colourfully or you're not alive.
Oh,
and
didn't,
Mel Brooks.
Didn't he do that?
Yeah. But Richard Purston insists life is too short to learn German.
No. There was a question on social media, which would you prefer to learn, German or French? And I went for the French because it's such a...
Well, most Australians seem to have gone for the French. I don't know why.
Yeah. Oh, it's such a lyrical, sensuous type of language.
Sure, and the opposite to German, which is guttural and... gruff somehow, yeah.
Yeah, I think I described it as more stilted than the French. French right, flows, French whereas German doesn't seem to.
Elegant and flowing, yeah.
And I said, look, that some people find that absolutely wonderful and good on them. It's just not to my taste. But interesting how our perceptions are about various languages. You know. But we might give you a bit of language of music, ladies and gentlemen, and be back in a sec.
Thank you.
And we have another awesome Aussie to reflect on too. This is also an Elizabeth. We had a look at Elizabeth Murdoch. This is an Elizabeth Kenny. One of her claims to fame is she grew to be America's most admired woman. She was slow to make it big in Australia. Perhaps one of the reasons, well, she's an Australian bush nurse with no formal training. But she did pretty well. Sister Elizabeth Kenny pioneered a treatment for infantile paralysis, or polio as we knew it. She became America's most admired woman in the process, met the president in the White House, and Hollywood made a film about her. But at home in Australia, Elizabeth wasn't treated well. She was sometimes ridiculed, and she was often obstructed. And today, few Australians have heard of her, which is a pity when you get something of her life story.
Mm.
She was born in 1880 in Warialda, a small town in northern New South Wales. Her dad was a farmer from Ireland. Her mother's father was a convict. He'd been transported from Ireland for stealing a horse. Elizabeth grew up with seven sisters and brothers on bush homesteads in New South Wales and Queensland. Young Elizabeth had a basic education at local primary schools. In her teens, she fell off a horse and broke a wrist. She was treated by a doctor called Aeneas MacDonald, who encouraged her to take up nursing. We think she was sometimes registered, but there's no record. As a bush nurse, Elizabeth travelled through the district on horseback to people who were unable to get to a doctor. She stitched cuts, staunched wounds, delivered babies, set broken bones, and one day she arrived at a farm to find a young girl suffering from a condition she'd never seen before. The girl had a fever and headaches. Her limbs were paralysed, and she wrote to Dr. MacDonald asking his opinion. He said, "I think she might be suffering from polio." Elizabeth applied hot, damp cloths to the girl's legs. She used massage and exercise to stop the muscles wasting away, and the girl recovered. 20 other kids in the district contracted the crippling disease, and the six treated by Elizabeth also recovered. But most doctors rejected her methods. They preferred this approach, which was to keep patients immobile and use splints and casts to prevent deformities. I was saying, Peter, that growing up, you often expected to find a couple of kids in the school with infantile paralysis.
Shame.
And it's such a distorting, horrible thing to get. You couldn't walk straight, you were twisted, and it was a painful thing, and was also not just debilitating, it was kind of terrible to observe. But it was just a standard thing until this Elizabeth Kenny got loose, and it's a high-tech solution, isn't it?
Mm. Well, one of my father's great friends, Kev, he was a survivor of polio, but...
Okay, right. He was... I bet he'd have vivid memories of school days.
Oh, yes, yes, well... His left leg, right leg was bent and not able to be straightened out, and he also had some back trouble from it.
Yeah, which is par for the course. Mm, yeah. And that the treatment, how scientific can you get? Hot, damp cloths and then massage and exercise. It was kind of, Elizabeth Kenny was a practical and organised person, and she could... cure polio, and no one else seemed to be able to.
It just seems such a bush remedy, doesn't it?
I suppose that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah, such a bush remedy.
I mean, it's effective. I'm not having a go at it, but it's just a natural type of thing. Okay, you can't move your legs. Let's move your legs for you so your muscles continue to work, and let's heat things up and see if that relieves the pain, you know.
I wonder what put the doctors so much against her.
I think one is because she didn't have a male anatomy and the other was that because she was a nurse.
So a nurse, they used to push her around and tell her what to do.
Well, look, I've been in discussions with various doctors about nurses, and they just, I think they feel threatened by nurses, and so they just put them down as lowest of the low, some.
Yeah.
And this is a bush nurse who mightn't even been educated or registered.
And yet how come in the United States she's welcomed as a miracle worker?
Yep.
And becomes a celebrity, and in Australia the doctors fought her all the way?
Well, she might have had the opposite effect in the United States, because she's from Australia. Yeah. And such a novelty in those days.
Yeah, and it was not as though they glossed over. It's the Sister Kenny Institute they built in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
So it's not a well-kept secret that she's
a woman
to be honoured.
That's right. Oh, look, that was the old America. You wouldn't get that in the new one, but they had some good taste.
Yeah.
Anyway, we've got to America without taking the rest of the story, so you better just
fill in a bit.
Concentrate on what you're reading.
Yeah, well, just for an Australian bush nurse with no formal training, Elizabeth Kenny did pretty well. She pioneered this treatment for infantile paralysis, or polio. She became America's most admired woman, and Hollywood even made a film of her. But at home in Australia, Elizabeth didn't do so well. She was born in 1880 in Warialda, a small town in northern New South Wales, and her dad was a farmer from Ireland. Her mother's dad was a convict. He was transported for stealing a horse. Elizabeth grew up with seven sisters and brothers. That seemed to be a royal number. My dad was one of seven brothers and sisters.
Well, seven's a heaven number, isn't it?
Yes. One of her siblings recalled, she's a real tomboy. She preferred to be outside riding horses bareback, not doing housework.
That's not surprising, really, given her history.
Yeah. Well, young Elizabeth Kenny had a basic education at local primary school, and in her teens she fell off a horse and broke a wrist. Treated by a doctor, Aeneas MacDonald, who encouraged her to take up nursing. And as a bush nurse, Elizabeth travelled through the district on horseback to people who couldn't get to a doctor. Stitched cuts, staunched wounds, delivered babies, set broken bones. And then one day came across this girl suffering from a condition she'd never seen before. The girl had fever, headaches, her limbs were paralysed. And when she wrote to Dr. MacDonald asking his opinion, he said, I think it's polio. And so she applied hot, damp cloths to the girl's legs. She used massage exercise to stop the muscles wasting away, and the girl recovered. Kids treated by Elizabeth also recovered, and most doctors rejected her methods and didn't seem to wonder why their patients didn't get any better. They preferred to keep patients immobile, use splints and casts to prevent deformities, and that locked the disease into the bones. So when World War I broke out in 1914, Elizabeth Kenny wanted to enlist. With a letter from a friend, Dr. MacDonald, as proof of her nursing experience, she joined the Australian Army Nursing Service. She served on troop ships, bringing the wounded home to Australia. She was promoted to Sister, a title she used for the rest of her life. Sister Elizabeth Kenny. After the war, Sister Elizabeth Kenny opened a clinic in Townsville to treat polio victims. And despite the usual opposition from leading doctors, the clinic was a success. And she opened clinics in Brisbane and interstate, and then in England. And in 1940, she travelled to the United States, where she began courses for doctors and physiotherapists. She's quite a woman, wasn't she?
Amazingly so.
Yeah. And where the Australian medical establishment rejected Elizabeth Kenny, in the United States, she was honoured as a miracle worker and became a celebrity.
The American medical people must have looked at what she was doing and seen it was effective. So yes. The difference being they were open to perhaps it working, and she gave them the evidence that it was working.
Yeah. And the 40s, while the war was raging on, well, she was writing an autobiography, And They Shall Walk.
Mm.
And she had lunch with President Roosevelt himself, a polio sufferer, which didn't hurt to add to her public status in the United States.
Mm.
And then in 1946 came that film, Sister Kenny, that immortalised and honoured her achievements. So Elizabeth Kenny's unconventional methods had helped millions of paralysed people to walk. She returned to Australia several times, but without acclaim. And on one of those visits in 1952, she died of complications from Parkinson's disease. Buried without ceremony, beside her mum in a small town cemetery near Toowoomba in Queensland. And that same year she died so poorly and quietly somewhere outside Toowoomba. She was voted the most admired woman in America.
I would hope that there will be some redress of her reputation in Australia.
Yeah, I can't see why or how, but maybe there will be people who'd be wanted to fight for that, at least some sort of reinstatement of the name of the Sister Kenny.
Yes, because she obviously was a pioneer, and obviously many people were helped by her methods and her work, despite the opposition from the medical side of things. Yeah,
and the doctors were opposed, I suppose, because it was... The thing seemed so conventional and simple, what she was doing. She's just washing the wounds down and keeping the muscles with massage quite flexible. And it was logical, simple stuff she was doing, and the medical profession weren't impressed for some reason.
I wonder whether it was because they had no idea what was actually causing it.
And so probably that. I wonder what does cause polio. It's
not
very
sure.
Contagious, but still you have kids with polio. I grew up with kids in my class in Toowoomba at St. Mary's, and they were kids with polio, and It's a total distorting disease. It makes you walk like a cripple and drag the foot behind you, and it's a terrible, disfiguring disease. But it was par for the course. A lot of kids had it. So It must have been the treatment was pretty unconventional and simple, and it worked.
I suppose, you know, as conservative as the medical profession is, perhaps they thought, well, we don't know what's causing it. That might work, but it also might exacerbate things in the longer term.
Yeah, I guess it could be as simple as that, but the medical profession seemed almost to a man to oppose her or to be unimpressed by the Sister Kenny approach.
To a man, hey? Oh, okay.
I wonder about the women doctors in those days. They didn't have much of a voice, for sure.
That's true. Now, let's have a look at the modern aircraft hangar. As a word existed centuries before the construction of the first plane. Its origin goes back to medieval times, though it's not certain to which language. Some believe that the hangar is derived from the Dutch hamgaard, described as enclosed space. Others trace it to medieval Latin, hangarium, for a shed in which the horses were shod. The hang part may recall the practice to suspend the animals for easier shoeing. The use of the word hangar for a covered space, particularly to garage carriages, as was known early in 1852, from a quotation from Thackeray's work. In his novel The History of Henry Esmond, Esquire, he makes one of the characters say, "Mademoiselle, may we take your coach to town? I saw it in a hangar." All the more surprising is the modern version of the origin of hangar as told by a close friend of the Wright brothers, who, in 1960, in the Monterey Peninsula Herald, attribute the creation of the name to their ingenuity. To start with, they kept their flying machine in what they referred to simply as the shed. When not in use, the wheelless plane was hung up in it, which gave them the idea to call the shed The Hanging Garage. It seemed
Hanging Garage, the hanger, yeah.
Yeah, it seemed a very simple apt description.
Yeah.
But too long to prove practical. So they shortened it to Hangar. So the first part of Hanging and the very first part of Garage. However, when they tried to paint the novel word on a board to serve as a signpost, using it for the side of an apple box, they could not get it on the limited space. They just simply left out one of the G's, contracted the two words, and then you had the word...
It was hanger.
Hanger. Yeah. I think we can just have a wonder at the ingenuity of that book and the person who wrote it, really. I don't think we'll ever find out where hanger came from.
However, that makes sense to me. That's kind of the way the process worked, and there the thing was hanging up from the roof in this big shed.
Yes, yes.
So what else would you call it?
Lots and lots of logic there, and but if other things such as that were called hangers, maybe it was just a word that through happenstance was the same as the Wright brothers called it too.
Yeah, perhaps it was an accident. Yeah.
I mean, it's a beautiful explanation for the Wright brothers. However, it predated them. So
just happenstance
that everything went the same way. But no argument about the word and its meaning, and one argument about time. It's gone away from us again.
I don't believe it.
I do. It's just, you know, I have to watch the time. All he does is read the books and have goes at me. Anyway, congratulations, Brian. You've done your 600th show.
Yeah, right. Thanks, Peter. It's been a pleasure and a joy.
It's been wonderful to be here for some of those shows too. So see you next week, ladies and gentlemen. And we'll say bye now.
And greetings from both of us, yep.
Believe and trust.